sorry that I can't join you for this discussion on academic freedom. Difficult personal circumstances make it impossible for me, to my regret. The immediate reason for this conference, as we all know, is the decision by the DePaul administration to deny tenure to Norman Finkelstein, a remarkable teacher and outstanding scholar, whose work has received the highest praise by some of the most distinguished scholars in the many fields in which he's worked, notably the founder of Holocaust studies and its most respected figure, the late Raoul Hilberg. And also the denial of tenure to another fine scholar, Marine Blaurdi, whose prime appears to have been her honorable support for Finkelstein. I'm not going to review this sordid affair. The basic facts are clear enough in easily accessible sources. Instead, what I'd like to do is say a few words about the general background for the ongoing assault on academic freedom. Perhaps a good place to start is with an observation by a prominent University of Chicago professor, Hans Morgenthau. He's one of the founders of the Realist School of International Relations. He condemned the intellectual classes for what he called our conformist subservience to those in power. Power comes in many forms. Typically, it's state or economic power, although one should not ignore the power of the defamation industries and depraved individuals associated with them who can lie and slander and vilify with impunity thanks to the media that tolerate and even encourage such behavior. The assault on academic freedom is broad, but it has specifically targeted Middle East departments and peace studies programs. That makes sense. State power is focused on war in the Middle East, so impediments have to be removed, and conformist subservience to those in power must be assured in these areas. The matter goes far beyond purifying academic institutions of faculty who reveal unwanted truths. Subordination to power can take many other forms. Just to illustrate, I'd like to take one recent case that has elicited a huge public outcry. I have in mind the appearance of Iranian President Ahmadinejad at Columbia University. In the background is the frenzied government media campaign to demonize Iran and its relatively powerless president, the new Hitler, if not worse. In fact, new Hitlers have been a familiar refrain in the doctrinal system for many years, with changes in the cast of characters, depending on current plans for subversion and aggression. The propaganda campaign about alleged Iranian iniquity is accompanied by threats of war that resound across the political spectrum, including every viable Democratic candidate. The threats are a serious violation of the UN Charter, if anyone still cares about these marginalia. The campaign may also lay the basis for future U.S. aggression in the region, probably with even more catastrophic consequences than the invasion of Iraq. Demonization is a conventional preliminary to aggression and therefore is not to be regarded lightly, particularly when it's carried out in an academic setting, which in a free society should be as untainted as possible by the conformist subservience to power that Hans Morgenthau deplored. Before turning to Columbia University's instructive contribution, maybe a few more words about the context would be useful. Wars are almost always defensive wars in the eyes of the perpetrators, at least in their words, as when the original Hitler invaded Poland in self-defense against what he called the wild terror of the Poles. And right now the ground is being prepared for a war of self-defense against Iran, in a manner which tells us quite a lot about the dominant intellectual and moral culture. So, speaking for a very large segment of articulate opinion, the editors of the Washington Post thundered that Iran is waging war against the United States and trying to kill as many American soldiers as possible, so we must fight back. What's Iran's aggression? Iran's aggression is its alleged support for Iraqis resisting U.S. invasion, occupation, and virtual destruction of their country right on Iran's borders. The propaganda campaign illustrates an important difference between totalitarian and democratic propaganda systems. In totalitarian societies, typically the party line is openly declared, obey it or else. The mailed fist takes care of the rest. In more democratic societies, that won't work. And accordingly, the party line is not articulated, and therefore it's protected from easy refutation. Rather, it's insinuated or presupposed as the framework for debate. And lively debate is then encouraged within that framework. Now, that has a double advantage. First, it makes it appear that the society is free and open. Simply look at the lively debate. But it also instills the party line even more deeply as the precondition for responsible discussion. It's accepted as an unchangeable, unchallengeable reality. It's something like the air you breathe. Well, true to form, the current charges about Iran's crimes do elicit a lively debate between the hawks and the doves. The hawks say we have to bomb them in self-defense in response to their aggression. And the doves respond that the evidence is not yet entirely clear, so we should delay before we obliterate them. By the prevailing logic, Russia would have been justified in bombing the United States in the 1980s, when Washington was quite publicly supporting resistance to the Russian invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. The CIA station chief in Pakistan, Howard Hart, reported that I was the first chief of station ever sent abroad with this wonderful order, go kill Soviet soldiers. Imagine, I loved it. The mission was not to liberate Afghanistan, so Tim Weiner writes in his recent history of the CIA, repeating the obvious, but it was noble anyway, he says. Presumably the nobility included the support for Reagan's favorites, who amused themselves by such acts as throwing acid in the faces of women in Kabul that they regarded as too liberated, and after the withdrawal of the Russian forces, turned to tearing the country to shreds, creating such havoc and terror that the population actually welcomed the Taliban. So killing Russian invaders and supporting crazed Islamic fundamentalist murderers, that was noble. But providing aid to forces resisting a U.S. invasion would be a shocking crime, which justifies military action and self-defense. And that stand is arguable on the tacit assumption that the U.S. owns the world. So a U.S. invasion is, by definition, right and just. It may be costly, it may be a mistake, it may be a quagmire, but it cannot be criminal, like comparable acts by enemies. Withdraw the assumption that the U.S. owns the world, and the entire debate about Iranian interference in occupied Iraq is simply ludicrous. Demonization as a preliminary to violence is standard operating procedure for good reasons. The primary reason is that the population is generally opposed to war and has to be whipped into hysteria about the ultimate evil that's threatening our existence. In this case, that's not so easy, so the propaganda efforts must be fierce. 75% of Americans are opposed to even threats against Iran and prefer entering into normal relations. Roughly the same percentage believe that Iran has the right to nuclear energy and call for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the entire region. That would include Iran and Israel. It's an idea that's virtually unmentionable in respectable society. Probably few of the respondents in polls are likely to know it, but they're actually endorsing the UN Security Council Resolution 687 of April 1991, to which Washington regularly appealed, though selectively, in its efforts to justify the invasion of Iraq. The resolution calls for, quoting it, establishing in the Middle East a zone free from weapons of mass destruction and all missiles for their delivery. Rather interestingly, Iranians and Americans are almost in complete agreement on these matters and in radical opposition to the government and articulate opinion in the United States. Okay, with that background, let's turn to Columbia University's contribution. Columbia University President Lee Bollinger introduced Ahmadinejad with a tirade that has no precedent that I can think of. Bollinger adopted, without question, the charge that Iran has committed the shocking crime of supporting resistance to U.S. aggression on its borders. Therefore, he accepted routinely the tacit premise that the United States owns the world. And he went on with the familiar refrain that's been trumpeted through the loyal media, which I won't repeat. The most apt comment I've seen on this performance was in Asia, in the journal Asia Times, which I quoted, said, an even more appalling measure of Western arrogance is the diatribe with which the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger, chose to greet his guest, a head of state. Were President Bush to be greeted in the same manner in any university in the developing world, the Pentagon would have instantly switched to let's bomb them mode, let's bomb them with democracy mode, to which we may add that Bush's crimes vastly exceed anything attributed to Ahmadinejad by a huge margin, in fact. The hysteria has its comical aspects, or what would be comical if it were not so serious, since Ahmadinejad kept from being too offensive. The media and commentators leaped on his silly statement about homosexuality in Iran that deeply offended Westerners who have such a stellar record in defending gay rights ever since gaining independence centuries ago. So who can imagine, for example, that President Bush would have been governor of a state that outlawed sodomy? And there's actually a lot more to say. Since we're concentrating on universities, we might recall the murder of the very distinguished mathematician and computer scientist Alan Turing by the British government, which forced him to undergo hormone therapy to cure his disease of homosexuality, leading to suicide. That year was 1953, which has a certain significance in U.S.-British-Iranian relations, not forgotten in Iran. It's worth remembering the reaction in the media and at Columbia University to the events of that important year in which the United States and Britain instigated a coup to overthrow the Iranian parliamentary system, imposing the iron rule of a brutal tyrant and torturer, the Shah. The New York Times editors were full of praise for the achievement. In their words, underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their number, which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism, seeking to control their own resources. Columbia University played its part by inviting the Shah to deliver the university's 1955 Gabriel Silver lecture dedicated to international peace, also granting him an honorary degree. In his lecture, the Shah urged that we must be strong enough internally and externally so that the temptation of subversion from within, supported from without, can be obliterated. The New York Times reported the lecture, an honorary degree, but without embarrassment. The headline reads, Shah praises U.S. for peace policy. Iran's ruler calls on West to bolster independent nations, as the U.S. and Britain had just done with such grace and nobility in the Shah's country. Colombia's delicate taste with regard to visiting dignitaries was revealed again when Pakistan's military dictator, Pervez Musharraf, visited recently. His country, of course, not only developed nuclear weapons and refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but also provides refuge to the world's champion proliferator, Abdul Qadir Khan, who did more damage in 10 years than any country did in the first 50 years of the nuclear age. I'm quoting James Walsh, executive director of Harvard's Managing the Atom Project. President Bollinger opened his fulsome welcome by saying, rarely do we have an opportunity such as this to greet a figure of such central and global importance. It is with great gratitude and excitement that I welcome President Musharraf and his wife to Columbia University. Mr. President, as you share your thoughts and insights, you will give our students, the leaders of tomorrow, firsthand knowledge of the world their generation will inherit. Maybe truer than he intended. President Musharraf, we thank you for being with us today, and we welcome you to Columbia University. To enhance the imagery, while Bollinger was once again conforming the state doctrine by berating Ahmadinejad, Musharraf's riot police were firing tear gas and beating lawyers and human rights activists, protesting Musharraf's plans to have himself reelected while serving as chief of the military, and blocking any viable alternative candidate. A few hours before Ahmadinejad arrived at Columbia, the university welcomed another distinguished figure, the president of Turkmenistan, another vibrant democracy with a stellar human rights record and plenty of natural gas, which the U.S. covets. That's just a sample, but it's perhaps enough to remind us that conformist subservience to power takes many forms in the academic world. Denial or withdrawal of tenure is only one. The current assault on academic freedom traces back to the activism of the 1960s and the elite reaction to it. This time of troubles, as it's called, had a dangerous civilizing effect on American society and culture in quite a few domains. Civil and human rights, opposition to criminal aggression, concern for the environment, critical analysis of dominant institutions and ideology, and plenty more. And that aroused deep concern and elicited a backlash that has taken many forms and continues today. A good indication of how the problems were perceived is given in a 1975 publication of the Trilateral Commission called The Crisis of Democracy. Should be borne in mind that this is a view from the liberal internationalist end of the political spectrum. So the Carter administration was largely drawn from the ranks of the commission. The crisis of democracy that troubled the liberal internationalist commentators was that 1960s activism was making the country too democratic. It was mobilizing formerly passive special interests to enter the political arena to advance their concerns. These dangerous special interests were women, the young, the elderly, working people, minorities, majorities, in simple terms, the population. And the commission called for more moderation in democracy, overcoming the excess of democracy in the 60s. The reason was so that the natural rulers would not be disturbed by ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the population, borrowing the phrase used earlier by Walter Lippmann, the leading public intellectual of the 20th century, expressing the same rather conventional thoughts. One specific concern of the commission was what they called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, the schools, the universities, churches, and like. They were not carrying out this task with sufficient rigor, and therefore they must act vigorously to inhibit the freedom and opportunity they were providing for independent thought. That's the liberal end of the spectrum. At the other end, we have today the attack by statist reactionaries who are outraged by what they call the liberal bias that subjects conservative students to punishment and instills anti-American, pro-Palestinian, and other left-liberal dogma, quoting press commentary. The press also reports that Congress is taking the first steps towards pressuring colleges to maintain ideological balance in the classroom, claims that scarcely merit ridicule in light of the realities of the academic world. The attack, however, is quite real. The press also reports that the House of Representatives unanimously passed a bill that would require university international studies departments to show more support for American foreign policy or risk their federal funding. The resolution, the unanimous resolution, was aimed particularly at Middle East programs, which, as I mentioned, are the main targets, along with peace studies programs. The late Baruch Kimmerling, one of Israel's leading scholars, warned of the dangerous consequences of what he called this assault on academic freedom by a coalition of neocons and zealous Jewish students supported by some Jewish mainstream organizations inspired by David Horowitz's crusade. The title of his essay was "Can a Patriotic Mob Take Over the Universities?" The article by this distinguished Israeli scholar was rejected by the Chronicle of Higher Education. Writing in the London Review of Books, Harvard University Middle East scholar Sarah Roy quotes Horowitz's attack on 250 peace study programs in the United States, which, she quotes Horowitz, teach students to identify with America's terrorist enemies and to identify America as a great Satan, oppressing the world's poor and causing them to go hungry. Now, the question is, how long can a nation at war with ruthless enemies like bin Laden and Zarqawi survive if its educational institutions continue to be suborned in this way? Well, it's pointless to debate such lunacy, but it's wrong to disregard it. The goal of the statist reactionaries is not to tell the truth. They know this is perfect nonsense as well as we do, but the goal is to extend the range of admissible options, extend it towards the repressive authoritarian end of the spectrum. And it's entirely understandable that Middle East departments and peace study programs should be the primary targets. Now, peace studies are inherently subversive, if they're at all serious. And Middle East departments might expose the truth about the region and about U.S. policies there, as Norman Finkelstein has done with scrupulous documentation and penetrating analysis. The truth poses a serious barrier to the policies carried out by state power and supported by all too many among the educated classes, whether it's invading Iraq to establish a client state and a base for U.S. power in the region, or restoring Iran to the happy days under the Shah, or destroying Palestine under the pretext of defense and democracy promotion, or a long series of other crimes. These crimes are likely to extend into the future in the region that President Eisenhower described as the strategically most important area of the world, which contains about two-thirds of the world's energy resources. 60 years ago, the State Department recognized that these resources constitute a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. And what is more, they are a lever of world control. It's a matter that's been understood by planners from the early post-war period until the present day. For example, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wasn't a particular supporter of the Iraq War, nevertheless wrote at its outset that a successful conquest of Iraq would provide the United States with critical leverage over industrial rivals. And he was, in fact, echoing remarks of George Kennan when he was a leading planner right after World War II, and explained that control of Middle East oil, which the U.S. wasn't using, but control over Middle East oil would provide Washington with veto power over allies. Now, the Bush administration understands the point very well. Control over pipelines can provide tools of intimidation and blackmail, Dick Cheney warned. It's control by others, that is. The control by us is for the benefit of the world. It's true by definition, another tacit presupposition that provides the framework for discussion in polite society. The assault on academic freedom has deep roots and ominous portent. It should be resisted with the steadfastness and the courage that has been shown by students of DePaul University, who have courageously and honorably protested its manifestation at their own university. In a free society, there should be zero tolerance for institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young or for the rest of the attacks on democracy under the cynical pretext of defending freedom.
I think we'd all like to thank Noam for taking out the time to send us this message in times of personal tragedy, and I now ask all the members of the first panel to join me on the platform.